Hello, this is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence. Well, I just got home yesterday from Hawaii, and while I was there, I had the pleasure to meet in person Justin Stein. And if you go back to March 21st, you will find an interview with Justin on the talk show. And I listened to part of it today and realized that Justin has a wonderfully complex but universal coming together kind of story. And it was really exciting to meet Justin in Hawaii the day before I left, actually. And of course, we didn't have enough time. I mean, we could talk for a week together, I think, and still not have enough time. So I had to, like, be okay with the couple 3 hours that we did have. He wants to interview me. I want to interview him. And together we've decided for this hour, I'm interviewing him, or at least we're having a conversation, and which will be published on the talk show. So, Justin, thank you very much for coming back again, because I have lots of questions for you.
Oh, it's such a pleasure.
So, for those of you who want to know about Justin's story, how he got to Reiki, where he's been, and where we're going from today, or where we're leaping off from today, I really encourage you to listen to the March 21st story, because that'll give you some background. But I'm just going to leap right in. Justin, in my mind, when I am interviewing someone, but also just in my life, when I'm confronted with a situation that I feel like, or an experience of somebody that I feel like is not one of mine, I try to place myself or imagine myself as you. You know, it's this, I guess it's this old thing about walk a mile in somebody else's shoes or something. But I see you as a scholar, one of those people who's going to be in education for the rest of your life, in one way or the other. I just really get this feeling from you. And also that this, the vision that you have of the world is so multidimensional. I have to assume that this is common from your generation. And also, it's very exciting for me because, you know, I was born and raised in a world where you selected your occupation, you got your education, and you did that occupation for the next 35 years, then you retired and you became a retired, whatever that occupation was. I mean, it sounds kind of boring, I have to say, but it was the focus of my generation's, you know, educational focus anyway. And our ambition, you know, our ambition was like, we want to be a lawyer, we want to be a doctor, we want to be a librarian, and that's what we were. And to switch jobs around was very avant-garde. So about, you know, 15 years ago, there were lots of magazines about articles about people who had been successful attorneys for 20 years, and now they had a kind of life-changing crisis.
Yeah.
And then they decide to go live in the woods somewhere and grow their own vegetables. I mean, you know, these are the kind of stories that were happening. But I just see that you represent, to me anyway, a generation that, because of the internet and because of the ease of travel and because of the ease of informational, cultural information being passed, you know, through all these different communication systems, that you represent a kind of worldview that I'm not really used to. So that's part of my excitement about talking to you, is that my mind just gets stretched enormously. And the other part that I felt like I wanted to just let you know is that I see you as an explorer. like I just feel that, you know, in like 100 years ago, people were going off and exploring new parts of the earth because, quote, no white man had ever been there before.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, it's a little bit racist and,
for sure.
Called,
colonial.
Colonial. Okay, so that's how we thought. And, but there's a place at which I see that the exploration of what's happening now is within the human experience. And that feels like an incredibly vast, place to go. And I'm just wondering if this feels accurate to you, because this is how I'm going to address you today. So if it doesn't feel accurate, then it's going to be really tough.
No, it feels exactly right. And everything you said about the education and about the kind of shape-shifting and about the kind of, you know, the flexibility and also about the, yeah, the exploration of kind of the inner world. They all sound right. They all sound
great.
Right on.
Great. Well, it's a joy to know you. And I have to say that, it's really fun to talk to you. And so I get to have fun now for the next 45 minutes or so.
Thanks. Yeah, me too.
So my first question is specifically about your thesis now that you're doing,
mm-hmm.
and this kind of spotlight in your multidimensional vision of Reiki, but going at something through exploring and researching the quote history,
mm-hmm.
and I'm wondering, if you know where you're going to go, I mean, if you have a destination and you will know it when you get there.
Well, it is the way that the dissertation project for, you know, American academia is structured is you write a proposal, which I guess in some way is almost like an explorer's, you know, intention of the direction you're going to head in, but right. You never really know what you're going to find. I mean, you have to be open to the data and let the data speak for itself, right? So, I feel like the history side of things is not, I don't want to collect, you know, a series of facts and of, you know, a kind of create. I mean, I love stories and I do want it to tell a story, but at the same time, you know, in terms of doing kind of, I see my work kind of intersecting with the historical and the social scientific and, you know, also the kind of openness that discourse analysis and religious studies kind of bring to the picture, where I'm really trying to show kind of linked worlds that the different people at different times and at different places in Reiki's history inhabited very different worlds. And because of that, Reiki for them filled, even though, you know, we talk about Reiki as being universal, that it filled very particular places in different people's lives.
Yes, I agree.
And so I think that's kind of the approach I'm taking, is to see kind of where, like, to open up different worlds at different time places and see what kind of role Reiki had in those spaces and times,
uh-huh.
for very individual communities, or individuals even, depending on kind of what kind of data I have.
Right.
Yeah.
So when you say that, I instantly go to my own process of thinking about the history in accordance with the four people that I recognize as the lineage.
Mm-hmm.
And so these, for me, are human time markers. You know, they're not.
Right.
And so I'm just wondering if you've expanded that more to other people other than the lineage.
Well, I mean, the thing is about the lineage is, you know, we don't have a lot of information, you know, about specifically, you know, Dr. Usui, Dr. Hayashi. We have, you know, some historical records of them, of who their family was and kind of, you know, the dates of their, you know, their coming into this world and their going out of this world.
Right.
We don't have, you know, we hardly have anything they wrote. We hardly have, I think there's people working on, you know, restoring this, and we've in the last maybe 20 years, you know, found some more documents. But, you know, as you stress, you know, Reiki has been an oral tradition, largely. And so there's not a lot of, you know, hard facts, I guess, about, who those two men were in terms of, you know, their inner worlds that right. we have, you know, remnants and we have traces, but we don't have a whole lot. But we do have, some contemporaneous, individuals who had studied, with Dr. Usui, who were contemporaries of Hayashi, you know, with, you know, maybe kind of, you know, had studied, you know, the Shinpiden level with him. And so we have a book by, Tomita Kaiji, which is called Reiki and Humanitarianism. And so, I mean, that's kind of another individual from the time period. I think the book was published, I don't have the dates in front of me, but I think the book was published in 35, which is probably right around the time, you know, your grandmother and master was over there. And so it gives kind of an alternative, vision of what Reiki was like in 1930s Tokyo. We also have, Eguchi Toshihiro. Apparently also studied with Usui and, created his own form of palm healing, which became more popular actually at the time in Japan than, Reiki was, or in the immediate pre-war and post-war period, at least. And so it's kind of another, I don't know what you want to call it, branch off of the Reiki tree or something like that. That's another kind of insight into what this type of healing was doing for people at this time in Japan. So those are a couple of other, maybe, I don't know if you want to call them alternative lineages or, but other kind of insights into the world of Reiki in 1920s, 1930s Japan, that I think are going to be profitable. Once my Japanese gets better and I can read the books in their original, I'm really interested to see kind of how that kind of fleshes out my understanding of that period. And then in terms of,
excuse me.
Oh, sure.
Just a sec. That's fabulous. And it's really neat to know that those books exist. And it brings me to, a metaphor that is used a lot. I have used it myself. Over and over again, and in the last few years, I'm shifting from one metaphor to the other. So the metaphor is of different branches or lineage and so on, and that works with my next step, which is to step back a few steps and to see it like a tree or like some kind of a pattern. Mm-hmm. That creates a bigger context. So it isn't about the separation of seeing these things conflictually or not agreeing, but actually in just seeing that each one of these ways that Reiki was taken out of Mikao Usui's teaching allows us to see the breadth and depth of his mastery. Not only, you know, as a human being, not just in Reiki, because Reiki was so new then, there, you know, that was just his means of communicating his own self-mastery. This is how I feel anyway. And so I see that all these different, ways that people were able to use his teaching and to be inspired by him shows us the totality of the depth and breadth of who he was and what his thought was and the gift that he brought back. So I'm really excited about this image of filling in the blanks more than finding different trees, so to speak. Does that make sense?
Sure. Well, you're seeing the organic relatedness or connectedness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also just, that I don't feel, I used to feel defensive, because mm-hmm. that's where these separations came from and where this, well, who's right and who's wrong. And I really believe that when the information as it comes genuinely or authentically all gets put together and then we see the puzzle. And I'm a great puzzler, so I really like that image. And I'm really happy to have somebody like you who's able, has the skill and the ability and the openness to really find the pieces of the puzzle.
Well, I'm working on it, and I'd have to say, you know, like every researcher, I'm indebted to a network of other like-minded individuals who are also uncovering things. But, you know, as you said, sometimes they come with their own agendas, and so you have to kind of unpack that as well. But certainly the work of Franz and Bronwyn Steen, the Reiki source book, has been an eye-opening thing for me in terms of, you know, again, it's some of the data you have to sift through, but they've done a lot of legwork. And also Robert Fueston has done a lot of, you know, years and years of research that I'm indebted to. There's also online, the James Deacon site has been very interesting to me. And so these guys all came before me. Oh, and also out of Vancouver, Rick Rivard. I mean, again, while I don't necessarily agree with everything all these people have written, their legwork is the kind of the generation that preceded me. Right. And so I am able to benefit from the hard work they've done and continue, especially, you know, I think that once my in about a year's time, so I know you know this, but maybe the listenership, just to let your listenership know, in about a year's time, I'm about to go into an intensive Japanese language program. So my research really, I feel like, will go to the next level next year, because I don't, to my knowledge, there are people working in Japan, kind of on Japanese stuff, and then there are people working, you know, outside of Japan, largely through translations and through, you know, but I don't really know of any researcher, maybe with the exception of Frank Petter, but who's really, you know, fluent in Japanese and able to work with the historical materials. And at the same time, you know, very well versed in the kind of what happened to Reiki since it's left Japan and English language materials and being able to kind of, synthesize those fields of research. And I feel like I'm in a really exciting time right now where, I have, you know, associates in Japan who are working on, you know, the early history, working on kind of the more contemporary Japanese, Reiki community, Reiki world, and or worlds, because it's not just one. And then, people who are working on kind of the Reiki in North America or Reiki in Europe, Yo-Yan Yonker, and that, you know, yeah, I feel like I feel very lucky to be in this almost kind of bridge, or I will be in this bridge position of being able to link scholarship written in Japanese and scholarship written in English and synthesize elements of that to try to bring a more global perspective.
Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that also I find is sometimes I find missing, and maybe it's just because of my own prejudices, but there is a tendency, of course, for all human beings to take whatever we read and translate that into the world that we know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of the great services, if it's at all possible, I don't know if it is actually possible, for someone to be able to, again, put themselves into the culture
mm-hmm.
from which these writings were published, because I think that's, context is such an important thing for the Japanese.
Sure.
And I feel like a lot of times this gets, not ignored, but it's because it's not actually conscious. It's just that we live in such an overabundant age of context that sometimes we forget about it.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I think it's it's, you know, the, you, it's all imagine, you know, you have to be able to imagine. I mean, it's a work to be, to do historical work. I think it requires a strong imagination that then, that is informed by reading of, you know, other works that, really give you the background information. And so I think that the longer ago you go and the more foreign the culture, the more difficult it can be, but that, you know, this is part of my preparation for my PhD. I just actually passed my exams, including a portion on specifically on late 19th, early 20th century Japan. And so the kind of the gleanings I've gathered from, again, the work of other scholars. And that's really, you're always connected to the work of other people because this is how you learn outside of your own experience.
Right.
And so reading about kind of the religious context of the period, the way that people were grappling with science, the way people were grappling with the mysterious kind of world that we might call parapsychology or kind of in between, you know, the spiritual and the scientific, things like hypnotism and spirit communication. I think it really has given me some more insight and some more understanding into the category that you might understand early Reiki as being part of this Seishin Ryoho, or the spiritual therapies of the time, which also include what we might call psychotherapy. That there was a category, well, because Seishin Ryoho in contemporary Japanese can mean psychotherapy, but at the time, Seishin is a word that has both mental and spiritual connotations from, you know, when translated into English. And so, in order to really understand what Seishin Ryoho might have meant to early 20th century Japanese, it requires a lot of kind of imagining different categories because you know, when the categories are different, you know, we might make a divide, you know, working with our English structured minds between the spiritual and the mental. And that is maybe a divide that didn't exist, you know, for these individuals at this time. Because of them just working in different categories, for example.
For example, right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean.
So many things.
Yeah, I mean, well, I had a few questions that got, now I'm on to something else. But it's great. Well, I think that's, it's really wonderful, and I look forward to, all your different, research projects, like, little pieces of your research. So what happened to me was that I was hanging out with, Shinobu Saito, one of the masters that, my grandmother initiated. And finally she just turned and looked at me and she said, you know, you have to find out who Mikao Usui was from the culture that he lived in, from the world that he came from.
Mm.
And that pushed me into actually doing very, very like surface research compared to yours in the history of Japan. And just that little bit that I did was so revealing to me. And it was really great because it did two things. One, it confirmed some of my feelings that I had. I didn't know where they came from.
Mm-hmm.
And then... And it also clarified and put into perspective huge questions that I had about who he was and what was going on with him. So I'm just really excited about where you're going. And that's great.
Me too. But what do you feel like came clear when you started doing these kinds of research?
Well, for instance, kind of obvious. So, for instance, when I just read a history of Japan and found out that 250 years before Mikao Usui was born, basically, this was the Tokugawa period and Japan was at peace. I mean, this is in quotes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Militarily. And it's where all of this energetic got compressed. And so because the warriors didn't have a battle to fight, they ended up concentrating on their inner journey and their own inner readiness to meet an enemy. But the enemy was obviously not necessarily somebody from outside, but was a part of themselves that wouldn't allow them to give another person an honorable death, for instance. I mean, these are all concepts that are, that were fairly foreign to me, right? And then to see that, you know, in this, that this guy, Commander Perry, who sailed into Tokyo Harbor at that time called something else, and, insisted on being able to land. And of course he had better military equipment in which to, back this insistence up. That totally changed everything in Japan. And this entry into the rest of the world in 1860s, something like that, was just, you know, I can imagine one person saying, oh, this is a renaissance, and the other person saying, this is a revolution. And and it felt like there were all these circles in Japan, you know, vying for recognition. And the relationship between the samurai, the shoguns, and the emperor were all involved in this. How do we, okay, so we've just thrown this all up in the air. Now, how do we really relate to one another? And that just was fabulous. And it made the movie, The Last Samurai, just totally make sense. I didn't really get it until then. And to think that this is exactly in the time period, these last years of the 1880s, that Makao Usui was born and grew up and had all these choices that if he had been born 20 years earlier, it would never have happened to him.
Right? Yep. No, so, he was born, what, 2 years before the war and 3 years before the restoration, you know, the beginning of Meiji. Yeah,
exactly.
And, that, yeah, he grew up in this world where, we're so, I mean, because there were limited types of Western influence before in certain ports, you know, the Dutch were teaching medical science, but that he was really part of a first generation where, you know, medical science, the beginnings of psychology were being, I mean, because if you look on the tombstone, they talk about all the different disciplines he was a master in, and it combines, you know, indigenous practices from the period, like physiognomy, divination, incantation, with, you know, medical science, psychotherapy, Buddhist philosophy, and so it's like all these different influences that, were kind of, he was, you know, one, I mean, there were a few people in prior generations who may have worked with Dutch physicians or read Japanese translations of Western medical texts, but that, that he, you know, probably, you know, was one of the first of a widespread generation. And in a sense, I mean, you talked about the generational difference, you know, with my generation growing up with informational access that may have been, you know, unthinkable a generation before. You know, you would have had to spend a lot of time in the library to find things that you can find in seconds with Google. I mean, in a sense, he also is at one of these junctions in informational history, especially, you know, for Japan, which had been a very closed society.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, that in alone just allowed me to flesh out, you know, and allowed me, as I said, to imagine myself being him.
Right.
And, I think that, and one of the things that I wanted to say before is that they don't acknowledge it very much in my, anyway, in my own family and in the people that I know who are Japanese. They don't acknowledge this, in public very much. But, you know, the Japanese are not just mystic. They really believe in the occult. And occult for me means, in this case, the Japanese kind of occult means this, really this line that you walk, that is through the mystery.
Mm-hmm.
But the occult assumes that a human being actually can learn enough to be able to make a difference in ways that for most people, for the majority of people, is a mystery and cannot be controlled.
Mm.
And so, it depends on your perspective about whether a cult is, black magic, which is what a lot of people refer to a cult as,
mm-hmm.
or whether it's white magic, if I may use these very non-politically correct terms,
mm-hmm.
white magic, which means that we have the ability to mature and to develop in our spiritual energetic self to the point where we can decide when we want to die.
Right.
And not from somebody else's sword.
Right.
And, this part of the Japanese culture is really interesting. And, from the very beginning, I absolutely did not want the kanji made public. And what I meant by that was I didn't want to see it, kind of as a, on t-shirts and, coffee cups and just used kind of blatantly as a design,
mm-hmm.
Because for me, it held this energy that was so precious and so, not understood. It isn't that it couldn't be understood. It just wasn't understood because none of us spoke Japanese. We weren't Japanese. So eventually I happened to have a conversation, with, people who were fluent in Japanese and who were Japanese and understood the culture. And they told me that the characters that, Mikao Usui chose, or the kanji, that he chose to use for Reiki were actually, implied occultism.
Mm.
And that for most Japanese, these were not public kanji that they would use openly in just conversation.
Well, but then you also have to, they're exactly right, I think, about certain things about that, but you also have to remember where they grew up is very different from where he grew up.
Uh-huh. And right, so, exactly.
And so you need to also see, because this is one of the things I've had a lot of conversations with, my friend, Hirano. She's, a graduate student. She's finishing her dissertation at Waseda University. And also on Reiki history. And one of the things that we've had a lot of conversations about is what exactly was what is the difference in meaning? What is the slippage over time of this word, of the character, specifically Ide? And how was it understood differently in, let's say, the 1910s and 1920s versus how its connotations are today? Because today it has a very spooky connotation.
Yeah.
And, it's used in, actually the term Reiki, can be used in connotation with horror films.
Uh-huh.
And kind of this occultist kind of connotation you're talking about. But that it has had a slippage over time and that, compounds, like for example, like today where you'll normally see it would be compounds about things like ghost. Or spirit,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
In spirit in the sense of a disembodied energy or,
right.
Entity, where back then it was used in different contexts. I don't have all my notes in front of me, but for example, I believe the compound Shinrei, that I was mentioning earlier, has the context of, non-physical, but not necessarily in a spooky context. And I wish I had my notes in front of me right now about my conversations, with Hirano, because I don't want to misspeak, but that, it was a much more common compound at the time than it is today. And it certainly had some occultist connections, that it was used in spiritualism. Right. For example, kind of scientific investigations into the spirit world were called Shinnei Gaku, like the study of spirit, in some sense. But that one thing that you see at, in the time is that, Usui Sensei was not the only one using the idea of, Reiki Ryoho, or, you know, Reiki therapy, that there were other people at the time who also had their own Reiki Ryoho. And so it was a more common word at the time, whereas today it certainly, I think, has kind of a creepier, I don't know, like a connotation of being, dealing with ghosts or dealing with something kind of scary a little bit. And I think that might be part of the reason why in Japan today, the kanji are very uncommon, that you, they, uh-huh. they use them as an explanation of what, which day, the reiki no day, the day in reiki refers to. But in most common, advertisements or books or, you know, just common discourse, they use the syllabary, the katakana syllabary, to write it out, the sounds of it, without using the characters themselves.
Oh, so, interesting.
So that, 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 inclination or that kind of, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Kind of intuition you had about, you know, that these characters have power, I think is something that has resonance in contemporary Japan as well.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, that was really interesting, and there was no way for me to, I learned very early on that controlling other people was not a very rewarding, experience. So I just gave up on it. And it's, and it's been really interesting because, I feel that now in the Western world, Reiki has be, you know, the kanji actually that's used, whatever form there it's written in, has become like a, what can I call it? A design more than a part of a language. And like the Sanskrit, I don't know, even know what to use, what word to use, but the Sanskrit om.
Yeah.
You know, has become a design.
Yep.
And
a tattoo. And,
yeah. And, you know, it's like, okay, so I got to get off my moral ethical idealism on this and just see that this is part of the movement of spirituality to become an everyday occurrence, like to become a part of our everyday lives.
Right.
And, you know, that's a little bit of sometimes my struggle with research, but definitely a struggle within myself as I see that I have to open up my own personal, druthers and be able to adapt to this next thing like Facebook or, you know, and friends on Facebook, which is really different than my friends. Right?
sure. It's a code language.
Yeah, but really.
One thing that I wonder about though is in terms of ritual masters, let's say, you know, of previous eras, would, like, what, how would they, because on some level, right, there's secrecy practices, you know, for certain reasons where, you know, the uninitiated are not to know certain symbols or not even to see certain symbols or actions. And then on another level, there's this idea that the power of these symbols can protect even those who don't really know about them. And so I wonder, you know, if let's say a yogi from, you know, to talk about, you know, from previous era, you know, how would they react to knowing how many om symbols are all over, you know, societies that really, you know, that's, they don't know any Sanskrit at all. That's like the one, you know, the symbol is, you know, it's a bumper sticker and it's a tattoo and it's a whatever. On one level, you know, is it a corruption or is it a kind of, you know, the Dharma taking over, you know, is that it's everywhere.
Right.
I could kind of see it going both ways in a sense.
Yeah, that's a much better way of putting it than I just did. And because I don't know the answer to this, but if you ever talk to somebody, I'd like to know.
Okay, yeah, well, it's a good question. It's a good question. And I imagine probably different schools of thought would have different answers to it. But I can certainly imagine, because you know, the use of talismans, has a very long history in Japan. And yes. I mean, it's one, you talk about, you know, people having a belief, you know, in what, our culture, you know, as our culture being kind of, you know, Western, you know, Euro-American culture, what might consider to be kind of belief in the magical or the occult or something. I mean, the enduring popularity and widespread use of amulets and talismans in Japan and among Japanese, overseas, you know, would suggest, you know, this belief in the power of kind of the empowered object that has, right. written characters on it, right? The characters right. that are part of the process. And so it's very different, I guess, to get, you know, 10,000 mugs, computer printed with the characters of Reiki and, you know, be selling them on your website. But on another level, like, in some sense, do these items have some sort of talismanic power? And I understand, you know, the concern for their, you know, perceived misuse or for the kind of the cheapening of the power of the symbol. But on the other hand, I wonder if, you know, if the characters do have power, if that power can be transmitted through its reproduction in other forms. I don't know. I mean, it's a question that I don't know if we're going to be able to answer, but that I too am interested in what other people have to think about that.
Well, you know, you alluded to this, a little bit earlier, a few minutes ago, about, initiated masters and, you know, people who have the information, secret information, but aren't initiated into the secret, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that there is a level of, how can I say this? A level of use maybe is the best and most clearest for me in my vocabulary. There's a level of use of these kinds of symbols that feels innocent. Mm-hmm. You know, like somebody goes, oh, that's a great t-shirt. And there's an om, you know, and glitter on the back of it, you know, and it looks very cool and they really love it and they're drawn to it. So there's an innocence about it. And then there's this other part that's definitely commercialism, mm-hmm. which, you know, that's just how it is. But also in commercialism, there is, I have seen and I've heard experiences of people, you know, connecting to Reiki through
right.
a t-shirt or something and going, well, what's that? Oh, that sounds interesting. And then, you know, following it along and all of a sudden they become very dedicated to the practice. So, I mean.
No, a friend of mine has a book that just came out about religious uses of manga and anime. Like
yeah.
And he talks about how during the Tokugawa period, there are basically comic books, you know, that are, scrolls that have combinations of text and images that were used to propagate Buddhist teachings.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you think about, okay, there's this entertainment value and maybe a commercial value where people are making money selling these things. But then, you know, the Buddhist idea of expedient means where kind of, it doesn't really matter how we get the Dharma out there. What matters,
right.
people are reading the, you know, finding out about the Dharma.
Right.
It's kind of an interesting, parallel, maybe.
Yeah, it is. Really interesting. Totally parallel. And then, so the next question for me is, you know, how do we integrate the sacred with the mundane? And I use a framework called the absolute and the relative universe. I got it from, the teachings of Aikido through Koichi Tohei, style of Aikido.
Okay.
And, I like this framework because what I realize is that there's the relative world where I'm in and I live in and everything is about relationship, right? And, you know, unfortunately toward the end it's, competition and comparison and, so on. And then there's the absolute, which is things are just so. So, you know, these symbols have this energetic that's applied to them. Now there's a whole nother study that I would love to see happen about symbology and human beings, and their tendency to use symbology to contact the unknown, mm-hmm. right? And this whole thing over here. So, for instance, the symbols that are used in Reiki, I feel like, come from this kind of, this, not kind of, but this unconscious or unknown collection of human symbology that are applied in this practice. But it doesn't mean that these are Reiki symbols in the sense that they only belong to Reiki. They are used in this practice, contrived by Mikao Usui for a certain purpose, and that's what makes them useful to us, mm-hmm. right? So then these symbols then get printed on business cards and so on. And is there some, so the question for me, which is unanswerable at this moment, is there some responsibility to discern the difference between using them in the absolute and then bringing them into the relative and believing that they can make a commercial difference?
Hmm.
And I, you know, this is an ethical question that reminds me of conversations that might have happened in the latter days of Atlantis. I mean, if we believe in the mythology of Atlantis,
mm-hmm.
or even Sodom and Gomorrah. So, mm-hmm. you know, there's this whole, I don't know, this is where my mind goes, but this is one of the things that I've been really interested in taking the pulse of what you're doing, because I feel like there will be some understanding, like there'll be a window that will open so that we'll be able to go further into our own understanding that will be coupled with our experience of practicing with these symbols.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that for me will be really solid because it will bring it into the everyday.
Exactly. Like to, I mean, in the same way, you know, I mean, I don't want it not to sound grandiose, but, you know, the story of Usui on Kodama and, you know, what it says on his memorial stone is that his greatness was not that he was able to receive, you know, the Reiki on the mountain, but that he was so benevolent that he brought it down and taught to others.
Right.
And, I think that there is this idea of, you know, there's certain things that are not to be broadcast, you know, that,
right.
but that there are other things that their very use is in their dissemination, right?
Right.
That without being shared, they don't have, you know, the power isn't being used, right? That there needs to be certain kind of access to the power in order for it to be, you know, to fulfill its purpose or something like that. I'm not exactly sure what to say, but like.
No, I get it. I get what you're saying. Totally. Because that is really the gift that even was recognized about my grandmother, like this, book, this famous, infamous book about, that Sally Hammond wrote. We are all healers.
Mm-hmm.
And she says in the book, and Hawaio Takata is the only healer that I have found who can pass this gift on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's amazing. And how he did that, I have no idea. And how it survives all the permutations and changes and, personal, molding into whatever we want it to be. How it survives all that and still touches people, that's just wonderful and is again maybe another question that won't ever be answered, but it's very interesting to just hold that as a kind of still point for me.
Certainly.
So I have one last question for you because we're kind of at the end of our time, unbelievably enough.
I believe it. when you start talking, I mean, that's what, and you're enjoying yourself, that's what happens, right?
Yeah.
Time flies by.
So we touched on this in our talk a couple of days ago, from your professors, and I'm really, there's something really important about this, especially in conjunction with the work that I'm doing in my own practice right now. And that is, this question about, will there be benefit outside of Reiki in this whole research? And, do you imagine that you will provide answers to questions?
Well, I guess it depends what types of questions. I mean, certainly.
Any questions.
Well, I hope so. I mean, that's, but I also hope, like you said the other day, I also hope that I'm provoking new questions. You know, that the other day before I spoke with you and I'd listened to some of the archives, I said, Phyllis, I was hoping that I'd be able to kind of answer some of my questions with the radio show. And then we, say, okay, well, we don't have to talk about this because she's already talked about it. But all it did was it opened new questions. And you said to me, well, then I've done my job.
Right.
And I feel kind of the same way in a sense where I hope that my work, helps illustrate or illuminate, not just, questions about what was Reiki like in 1954, which is one of my big questions. I have no idea what Reiki was like in 1954 exactly, but also that it teaches us about, people from different cultures interacting with each other and, the development of certain practices or systems as the product of intercultural interaction and of, a combination of the dedication of individuals who, have, their own experiences and their own kind of trials and errors and recreations and syntheses. But then also, kind of the context that those individuals lived in. And so kind of the way that, I mean, for me, the scale I'm looking at really has to do with interactions between North Americans, people living in Hawaii, and people living in Japan, right? And that this has been going on for a lot longer than, the narrative, that's often shown or, explained or described in Reiki was, there was this original revelation in Japan and, the original practice was very Japanese and that, there's been this degradation over time or it's gotten more American and we have to fight the, I don't know what you want to call it, corruption or the degradation. But what I'm seeing is really that in Usui's Japan, he lived in a Japan that was enamored with America and with,
right.
A lot of ideas that were new and exciting and with the growth of science and with, the growth of the things like hypnotism and spiritualism. There's a lot of intercultural currents going on in his time. So in what sense can we say, Reiki is strictly Japanese or purely Japanese? Even in the earliest times, it seems like it's kind of the product of trans-Pacific interaction. And so that's one of my big kind of, it's something that gets me wanting to learn more about the 1920s Japan or 1910s, 1920s Japan is to see In Dr. Usui's world, what were his motivations? In the story your grandmother told, right? His motivation was a Christian motivation, right? And while that story, may have its own kind of spin or whatever, that there is a sense that I have that it's not a purely, traditionally Japanese practice, but it's a modern practice that's come out of provocations between intercultural contact. And so I think, that this whole, that's something that it's kind of a hunch. It's something that I want to, pursue. And if the data's not there, obviously, I'll drop it. But I have a feeling, that, the precepts, for example, are a combination of indigenous Japanese and Buddhist. I mean, it's the Buddhist vocabulary, the five precepts is a Buddhist, word, gokai.
Yeah.
And there are elements of it, you know, the gratitude, for example, that have a lot of continuity with earlier, what you might call like self-cultivation practices, from the Tokugawa era, for example.
Uh-huh.
But then I also wonder to what degree, you know, the belief in the power of intention and control over one's emotions were inflected by, you know, growing psychotherapeutic or spiritual therapeutic, you know, the Seishin Nyoho of the time. And from the preliminary research that my associate Hirano is doing, it seems like that the context for the precepts, at least, has kind of inflections of North American ideas about the power of the mind and about the power of intention. And so, you know, to some extent, I'd like to show if it is the case that Reiki has always been about a meeting of, you know, trans-Pacific cultural currents. And that's what we're all engaged in, I think. It's not just the Pacific, because there's, you know, obviously a big Reiki community in Europe and in India, but that, the first 70 years of Reiki was the result of kind of these people, you know, combining Japanese elements of Japanese and elements of, you know, North American practices, whether they lived in Japan or Hawaii or North America, you know, I feel like there's this productive confluence going.
Uh-huh.
That's one of the things I'm interested in kind of unpacking in the historical data. So
great. Sounds wonderful. That was really a wonderful overview. Thank you, Justin.
Yeah, thank you, Phyllis. It's really, as always, a pleasure to talk to you.
It's been great. And for you listeners, stay tuned, because there's going to be a part 3 sometime in the future. So this is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence.